Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
The reality of that as an operator is that, yes, your leases are triple net, so you're covered from an expense standpoint, but either way, your tenants are paying it, and they can only pay so much rent. It's base rent plus CAM. So if your CAM is another dollar higher, then your base rent is going to have to suffer.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Best Ever listeners, welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm your host, Joe Cornwell, and today I'm joined by Michael Parrott. Michael is the Director of Acquisitions for SunCap Real Estate. They are a fund that focuses on flexed industrial and grocery anchored retail assets in the Southeast. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me so much. It's an honor.
I'm looking forward to talking about what you guys are investing in. I know it's your first time on the show, so why don't we spend a little bit of time and talk about your background, where did you grow up, and then how did you initially get into real estate?
So I was born and raised in Western North Carolina, nearby to a town most people know of called Asheville. And I actually grew up in a construction family. We installed hardwood floors, worked on commercial sports flooring. That's what my dad still does to this day. Also does a lot of contracting work on my personal investments. Grew up in a sports background. That's what brought me to South Florida, where I currently live. I was recruited as a preferred walk-on to play football for the University of Miami. Was blessed and highly fortunate to earn a scholarship my second year on the team. Being down here put me around a lot of great people that were in the real estate industry, which I knew I wanted to be in. I used to sit on job sites with my dad and say, we're doing great, but the guy we're working for has really got the good job. He's really making the money. So that's where my appetite for real estate was born. But I was mentored by a gentleman named Peter Gardner, great friend of mine and mentor to this day. And he was and still is the partner at a private equity fund called Long Point Realty Partners based out of Boston. I started with them pretty much just brokering deals. Same asset class as what I'm doing now. Was fortunate enough to get some big hits at a young age. I'd go to football from 5 a.m. in the morning till lunchtime. And then I would go and work around noon to 4 p.m. And then I would end up in class all evening long. So that's where my passion for real estate was born. I was able to parlay that into a little bit more of a boutique shop with what I'm doing now at SunCap Real Estate Investments. So instead of being 15 steps down the ladder at Long Point, I'm pretty much the partners and then me, which is more entrepreneurial, much more my speed and what I was looking for.
Okay. And were you doing personal investments or did you go straight into working with the funds? How was that transition?
It's always been sort of a blend and a hybrid. I guess you could say day one, it was much more of working with Long Point, pretty much in a brokerage capacity, which formed into an analyst, which formed into performing underwriting while also sourcing deals for Long Point simultaneously. And then as I was able to accumulate money, really earn some fee income and have a little money to do something with is when I began to dabble in my own personal investments. I guess I started off big. If you're going to do something, do it big, I suppose you could say. So we can get into the discussion later, but ended up taking down some land. Took my, what in hindsight was extremely novice, low level knowledge, but enough that I had learned from class and being around people who had done it themselves, like Peter, other mentors that I had in South Florida, and I was able to take the land through the entitlement process, start the preliminary work with the engineers, architects, so on and so forth, and then bring in a family office who, it's a whole nother long story, but actually sourced their portfolio of industrial assets down here in South Florida. It was one of the first deals I ever did. Came into a bigger relationship. They so happened to move to Hickory, North Carolina, which is nearby to Asheville. We're doing multifamily developments there. And the rest is history. It kind of worked out. I have retained equity in the project. We're co-GPs on the deal. It's always been a little bit of a blend of both and probably always will be.
Yeah, very cool. I like that you obviously work full-time career in real estate, but you're also taking your personal funds and investing in real estate on your own deals. So the fund you work with, I know you said you guys are heavily investing in flex industrial. For anyone who may be unfamiliar, can you just break that down? What is it and why do you guys like it?
Flex industrial, the way I like to describe it, there's a serious way and there's a comical way. So start with the serious way. We're investing in what I call critical workplace infrastructure. And what that is, essentially, down to the nuts and bolts of it, is it's typically around 20 to 25% office in the front portion of a rectangular building with around 75 to 80% of open warehouse space in the exterior of the building. And it's normally somewhere between 2 and 10 buildings comprised of a larger, say, 150,000 square foot park. And these buildings are geared toward your contractors, white collar professionals such as engineers and architects, the type of people that are in the service industry that come to your house on a day-to-day basis to perform whatever services you may need as a homeowner. And they're renting out these offices in the suburban location, typically with good access to a freeway, paying a, depending on the market, a high single digit to a mid-teen rent typically, as opposed to paying probably 50% more in a multi-story office building in the CBD. And they have roll-up garage doors on the back to where sometimes they're dock high, but typically the product we're buying is just a roll-up 8 to 10 foot tall garage door, big enough to fit a Sprinter van in and out of, or a pickup truck, whatever these service technicians are using. So that's my serious definition. And then my comical definition is short and sweet, simplistic. We're the mullet of real estate. We're business in the front. We're your white collar office space in the front, your front office. And we're the party in the back with your service guys in the garage doors. So
I like that analogy. Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so you said these typical properties you're looking at are anywhere from 150 to 200,000 a total square foot, right? So that's office and warehouse space.
Yeah, we'll do smaller acquisitions, but that's our sweet spot.
Okay. And what are these on average broken up to as far as units, suites, whatever you want to call it? How are those typically divided?
So that's our critical piece of our business plan is you can buy these buildings in any configuration, anything from 1,000 to 20,000, 50,000 square foot suites. But for us, we don't like to take a high concentration of risk in any one given tenant. I think for any investment, it's good to diversify yourself. So we really focus on a large rent roll with a diversified tenant base. So we like to see, say, 1,000 to 5,000 square foot suites on average. To give you an example, we recently bought a 144,000 square foot deal in Knoxville, Tennessee, called West Bearden Park, and it had 62 tenants, I believe. So you do the math on that, and it's 2,700 square feet per unit, I believe, something along those lines.
Okay. That makes sense. And yeah, I like that strategy to help minimize risk there with not having just a handful of large tenants. And I know you mentioned you're investing in the Southeast, so you've already mentioned a couple markets. What markets are you most interested in today?
I'll give you the state breakdown first, and then I'll give you some particular MSAs. So we like Virginia, Tennessee, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and our partners and myself like to spend some time in Colorado, so we got some outlier assets out there. But the particular markets we own and are screening opportunities in Richmond, Virginia right now. Haven't bought anything yet, but would go to Norfolk. We own in Knoxville. We own in Nashville. In 2 weeks, we'll own our first asset in Nashville. We would go to Chattanooga. We would go to Johnson City. There's just not a lot of product there. The Research Triangle area in North Carolina, Wilmington. We would own and will continue buying in Asheville, North Carolina, where I'm from. We've done more transactions in Atlanta, Georgia than anywhere else. And pretty much open to most larger MSAs in the state of Florida. And we currently own in Colorado Springs, Aurora, Denver, and I think I'm not missing anything, but a couple markets in Colorado.
So what is it about the Southeast that you like?
I think that like most everyone else, you go and you do some basic market research and you see that the growth is going to where there's good weather, good jobs, and you can look at whatever way you want to look at this, but typically a more business friendly climate. You can interpret that how you want to interpret that, but I think those are the places where growth is going. And then on top of that, if you look at the different markets we're in, there tends to be a university presence in most of them, which relates directly to jobs. And that's where people are living.
Okay, so back to the flex industrial. Why is that your bread and butter? Why do you guys like it so much?
Well, there's a lot of great reasons, but I can give you three that I think are the most important. Number one is like any investment where somewhere where you can not control the supply, because we can't control the supply here, but we can predict the supply pretty easily because these buildings, if you think about the actual construction of them and you think about our strategy that I'm explaining to you of small bay sizes, and what is that? Say you've got a 30,000 square foot building and say you've got 12 units in it. So what that translates to 12 demising walls, 12 HVAC units, 12 offices, 12 bathrooms, 12, 12, 12, 12. So the incremental cost of developing these buildings is much more expensive and cost prohibitive as opposed to developing an Amazon warehouse. An Amazon warehouse you can maybe deliver for, I'm ballparking here because I don't build them every day, but say it's 60 to 80 bucks, if I know it's a big range, per square foot all in, as opposed to these buildings, 130 to 150 bucks a foot all in, if you're constructing tilt-up walls, 18 to 24 foot clear height with somewhere between 20 and 30% office finish. So it's a drastic difference, and not a lot of this product is being delivered. You look around the United States anywhere, you pull up Coast Hard Reports, you talk to local builders, local brokers, no one's building this product, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. If it is being built, it's only metal buildings because the cost of construction is much lower. Extremely hard to get debt on those properties. We've actually just secured debt on one in Gastonia. Not easy. So that's number one. Number two, it's an affordability play for the tenant. And that's from our perspective, from our business plan. We're renting these small suites, 1,200, 2,000, 2,500 square feet. It's a feeder system. We start guys in from day one. They just started their business all the way up to, all right, now I'm a 7,000 or 8,000 square foot guy. I'm either going to go build my own space or go to a larger industrial park that can accommodate me. So we're able to provide an affordable space for our tenants. And because of that, there's excess demand where we have waiting lists. Literally, in most of our properties, we have double-digit waiting lists for people to get into our properties.
Sorry to interrupt. You said those were about $10 to $15 a foot. On average is about what you're
typically
about what you're getting. Okay. All right. Continue.
Unless you go into gateway markets like Miami, which is where I'm sitting in South Florida, you know, you're seeing low 20s to mid 20 rents here, but it's an outlier. But the deals trade for a lot more because of that. And then the third reason is we're able to expose and take advantage of extreme operational inefficiency because the people who typically own these assets are mom and pop local operators, which there's nothing wrong with. That's not me making a derogatory statement. It's just the fact that a lot of the time these people have built these assets and or bought them 30 years ago. We deal with it every day, and their cash flow is healthy. They're fat and happy, and they're not pushing the rents on these tenants. We bought one in Asheville, North Carolina back in last May. The rents were literally across the board 60% under market. So we've pushed rents 30 to 40%, and the tenants are still happy because they know they're getting a good deal. And that's common in this type of asset class. And because playing into that same comment, we play in a space where institutions are not playing. They're messy. There's a ton of tenants. It's operationally difficult. So we have a nice niche space where, yes, there's buyers out there, but when you're buying a $30 or $40 million deal, there's only so many of these middle guys like us that are able to go and actually have the capital to take them down.
That makes sense. And that one you mentioned sounds like a good one. We maybe can dive into some of the details on it if you can. What was your acquisition at? How much rehab, if any, on the build outs? And then what do you think the value is going to be when you're exiting either refi or sale?
This deal is called Elk Mountain Business Park. It's in my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina. It was 96,000 square feet and change. It had 48 tenants, I believe, around an average base size of 1,500 to 2,000. I forget exactly. But we went in. The average triple net rent was around $6. I believe, in a $14 market. Bought it last May. The debt market was really tight. Actually knew the owners from an arm's length. Did work with my dad growing up and was able to play that relationship well. And again, this is not me making a derogatory statement like Buzz and Brett, if you're out there listening to this at any point, like I don't mean this negatively, but they were operating it so below market that they were able to achieve the same cash flow by owner financing the deal to us. And they put $3 million in their pocket. To go to that point, it was a $107 a foot acquisition. We put $3 million in their pocket on the down payment, got a 5.5% rate, I believe, on a 5-year term, interest only. And the deal's cash flowing extremely well. We've went in and most of the tenants were on handshake month-to-month leases because Buzz and Brett are just awesome guys. They're trustworthy. All our tenants are trustworthy, good people. So, but it was very informal. We came in. Put everybody on 3-year leases. We're pretty close to executing that business plan, minus some tenants that just haven't expired because some people were on leases. But we've pushed rents 30 to 40%, put in a professional management company that's also doing our leasing. I mean, people are still under market, frankly, and the tenants know that. At the end of the day, it's tough Some people have left, but most people have not. People realize that I'm still under market. These guys aren't ringing me for every dollar that they possibly can. They're executing their business plan, but we're still getting a fair shake here.
Yeah. Are you able to give me the purchase, and then what do you think it'll be worth on the back end?
So we bought the deal for 107 on 96,000, so about $10.5 million, and we'll be able to take rents to 12 to 13 bucks property wide. Like I said, we're not going to juice every penny out of it. So say NOI will be $1.3 million, 1.2. You cap that conservatively at a 7 cap, that's a 14x multiple on that. So conservatively, you're looking at $18.5 million on the back end. And that's with 7 cap is generous for any flex industrial asset. It's probably going to be a lower cap than that.
Okay. So that's what you're seeing in these markets you're looking in predominantly is around 7?
No, you're seeing much less, but we underwrite accordingly. If our investors go and look at our performance, it's going to say something along those lines. What's very interesting about this asset type is, like I said, there's not a lot of it, regardless where you go. So the cap rates don't really vary all that much if you go Asheville to, say, Raleigh. Now, if you go from Raleigh to Miami, Florida, yeah, there's going to be a cap rate compression in Miami because everybody everywhere wants to buy flex in Miami. But there's not a whole lot of spread on the cap rate.
Okay.
We'll get back to the show. But first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane. And it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
It's interesting. So I'm based in Cincinnati, and we do have some flex development going on, but based on the guys I know in that space, it doesn't sound like it's even going to meet the demand that there already is once they're all online. So as you said, the demand certainly outweighs the availability of inventory. So in your experience with these, what percentage of tenants end up being delinquent or having to be forced out, evicted, whatever your process is with them? Would you consider it higher or lower than other asset types or residential maybe?
So you were asking about delinquencies?
Yeah, if you had to estimate what percentage of tenants during their lease term fail, stop paying, move out, or have to get evicted.
I mean, give you an example with Elk Park. We have literally turned 30 some odd leases now, maybe close to 40. And we've probably had 5 tenants vacate just because they didn't want to pay the rate. I don't know where else they went, but they didn't want to pay the rent. And then at any given time throughout the year, you may have one tenant that just is delinquent, not paying the rent. But I would say there's not a lot of that. You're dealing with business people, business folks who it's not rent. It's not a necessity item. It's just a cost of doing business. This is an operational cost for them. And as far as vacancy, CoStar has good data as far as vacancy rates across any asset class and all the markets. If you look at any market, you're pretty much seeing somewhere between 0% vacancy and 3 or 4% vacancy. This is, like I said, there's not a lot of supply.
Gotcha. Let's shift over to the grocery anchored retail. So why do you guys like that and where are you looking for those?
We like grocery anchored retail because we see the strip component of it as almost identical to that of flex industrial. You're seeing a lot of the same service oriented. I mean, it's retail, obviously, but the same type of mom and pop tenants, lower square footages. The unit sizes are small also, a lot of lower concentrated risk, with one large anchor that serves as the cap rate compression on these deals. These things are trading at lower caps. We're buying them in more secondary and tertiary markets with a high quality grocery like a Publix or a Kroger, Albertsons, whatever it is. And we typically are buying them at, say, mid sevens to high 7 cap rates. We even bought one in Richmond at 8.5 cap. So on our exit, when we sell them in a portfolio, our exit cap rate is lower, but on one-off assets, they're great yield plays, I guess is the point I'm making. This retail assets trade at higher caps, and we have two different funds, which I'd like to touch on more in detail later, but this serves our yield-driven income fund very well because we're buying at higher going-in caps.
Gotcha. And on these deals, are these heavily distressed assets? Are they mostly occupied? What is the strategy in a typical deal when you're looking at the retail?
So our typical strategy, they're always income fund deals, which means stabilized in our terminology. So typically no more than 7 or 8% vacancy. And they are a dividend-based deal. The investors who ran on these deals with us are typically an older demographic looking for quarterly distributions. So they're usually a stabilized play at a higher cap.
Okay, that makes sense. You said these only have about 7 or 8% vacancy. So these are, as you mentioned, relatively turnkey, stabilized, so to speak. Are you going in there? Are you doing any major CapEx, any updates to these buildings? Are you raising market rents substantially? Obviously, you're going to attempt to fill those vacancies. But what specifically is your strategy for most of these retail centers?
So it's on a deal-by-deal basis. I'll give you an example, a case study, I guess you could say, from called Village Marketplace in Midlothian, Virginia, which is a suburb of Richmond. And this deal is a 1980s vintage center, around 150,000 square feet total, 50,000 of that being a Food Lion with, I think, 30 years term left on the lease. And it's arguably somewhat of a subjective statement, but one of the best corners in Richmond, Virginia. You're surrounded by Whole Foods, actually two of them, Fresh Market, some of the higher end homes in Richmond, Virginia. So the plan here was we bought it from local ownership that had neglected the property for years. They were honest. They didn't hide it from us, but we knew it was going to be all new roof replacements, which we've actually already executed upon. Cost us $10 a foot on 150,000 square foot assets. You can do the math there. Very large capital expenditure. The asphalt was what we refer to as alligatored everywhere, meaning that if you ever look at the scales of an alligator, it's these cracks, little circles all over. So we had to bust up the asphalt and put a new layer of asphalt down. The entire shopping center, we gave it a new paint scheme. Right now, as we speak, a new podium sign is being installed, which will provide previously only the big box tenants, the anchor and the junior anchors had signage. Now each of the inline tenants has signage and better exposure from the road front. We had to go in and implement some just basic security measures because they didn't even have security cameras at the property, believe it or not. So we went and did that, put in professional management. We typically manage the accounting and financial of all of the properties, so all the K-1s, distribution, so on and so forth, run through us. But the boots on the ground management is ran through a local company. They deal with vendors, get proposals, basically we sign off. Put in professional leasing. Previously, the local group was just doing it all in-house, and it was being done quite ineffectively. So that's the typical business plan. And on these income fund deals, because it's a going in higher yield and a lower IRR target, we're not really looking for some gross appreciation in the rents. I think we underwrote around 26% NOI growth over a 5 to 7 year hold. So at the end of the day, that comes down to just slightly more than 3% rent bumps annually.
Now on all these tenants, and obviously I know it'll be case by case, but generally speaking on these longer term leases that you're putting with the flex space or with the retail, are you doing the built-in increases in those longer term leases?
Definitely. So it's all market dependent. In some markets, you can get 2.5%. In some markets, I've seen as much as 4 to 5%. But I think the average sweet spot for most groups when they're out there underwriting a deal is around 3% that we build into the leases.
Gotcha. Anything else you want to add on the fund?
I would like to go in for anybody out there that's listening that has any interest whatsoever in taking LP positions in an industrial slash retail fund. Go into the dynamics of our fund structure and some of the benefits. So we have, like I said, two funds. One of them is a value add, what we call our growth fund. And that fund targets a lower day one yield. Sometimes we start out at 3-4% on the going in yield, but there's always 45%+ NOI growth baked into those deals, which results in a higher IRR of around 14 to 15% as a target. And on our income fund, you go in, I've kind of already said this, but at a day one, we're pretty much clipping around a 7.5 to 8% cash dividend to our investors. Much more conservative rent growth. Typically, the assets are stabilized or very close to it. So our overall return is around 11%. But what is very beneficial to our investors, and we're not the only people out there offering this, but we were actually having a conversation with an RIA today out of Charlotte that's looking to allocate some capital to us from his investors. And what was extremely attractive to him and to his investors is, yes, our returns are relatively modest. We'll talk about the growth fund, say it's 6% and 14%. But when you look at that on a tax efficiencies that we offer to our investors, that's completely tax shielded. Almost always 4 years, sometimes even the fifth year of the whole period, just depending on what capital improvements we do, because we're able to pass down that depreciation to our investors. So say you're making by year four an 8% dividend because we've added the value, maybe it's 8.5%. That's a true 8.5% in your pocket after taxes. So if you went and put that into your Roth IRA, you invested into some small cap growth stocks, say you go earn 8.5% in the S&P or wherever you have it, really what you're going to put in your pocket is around 5%, because you're going to pay 30%+ of that to the IRS. So that's one of the main benefits we really pitch to our investors, is you're getting a growth, almost an equity-like return with what we refer to as almost a bond level of risk due to the tax efficiencies of investing in a fund structure like this with real estate.
That makes perfect sense. Definitely interesting strategy. So are you ready to transition to our best ever lightning round?
Yeah.
All right. Give me your best ever book recommendation.
I recently read a book. It's a book from Sovereigns Capital, and it's called Faith-Driven Investing. And Sovereigns Capital is an investment fund that has a little bit over $1 billion under management, to my understanding. And they only invest in companies that have a faith-based, specifically Christian-driven principles. And when I say principles, like the people running the company have some sort of faith-oriented perspective to their business. And some really insights that I pulled from that is, I guess, as you can probably tell by me even bringing this up, is that the principal of our firm were very heavily guided by our faith and by our moral compass. And I guess sometimes you think about the way in which you operate your assets, and am I doing this in a way that glorifies the kingdom? And the biggest thing I took from the book is that, is the pursuit for money, is it greed, or is it you going and fulfilling the talents that God has given you to your highest potential? And basically one of the main points of the book is that God gives each one of us a certain talent. Maybe it's multiple talents. And for us, we believe that talent is capital allocation, sourcing, underwriting, and the various facets of doing a real estate deal. And if you aren't doing those to the best of your ability, you aren't ultimately honoring the gifts that God has bestowed upon you. So a fantastic book. I think it's wonderful for any Christian men and women who are not only wanting to make a dollar and create great yield for their investors, but also operate their business in a way that glorifies God. Great book. Just check it out. Would love to give you the information after the podcast.
Very cool. What is the best ever way you like to give back?
So I was part of an organization during college that many people are familiar with called Fellowship Christian Athletes. And I have a whole testimony related to the organization that I love to share with people. But basically that from my day one of stepping on the University of Miami football field, the organization impacted me. Our team pastor, Mike Blanc, salt of the earth individual, invited me to what he calls the FCA huddle, and then invited me to church on Sunday. That's still the church I go to this day. I mean, the FCA touched me throughout my career, from bringing me up in my times of when my athletic career was trying and maybe I didn't have the best morale at times. People within the organization were right there for me to invite me to church, invite me to their house, take me out to lunch, whatever it may be, just to not only encourage me, but correct me when probably my attitude was in the wrong place. And then FCA even helped me land the job I'm in today. I mean, I think it's just a phenomenal organization that is both faith-based and career-driven. I was able to meet the principals of the firm that I'm working with now through a speaking engagement I had with FCA. And so because of that, I was approached to be the chair of the fundraising board. And that's one of the biggest ways that I contribute charitably at this point, is both raising and giving money for the University of Miami chapter of Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Phenomenal organization.
Give me a mistake you made in one of your deals and the lesson you learned from it.
So most recently, I guess I'll give you an example of underestimating the insurance rates in the state of Florida. We were underwriting a deal in northern Florida up in Jacksonville, and we assumed basically because the previous owner had around 50 cents a foot on insurance that, oh, if they're getting it, we can get it. But the reality of that was we didn't flush it out deep enough, and they weren't insuring the full value of the building, nor were they getting full income replacement on the NOI of the property. We actually got an insurance rate around $1.50. When you multiply that times 250,000 square feet, that's a significant difference in annual expenditures. And people sit there and tell you, oh, well, the leases are triple net. You pass it through to the tenants. But the reality of that as an operator is that, yes, your leases are triple net, so you're covered from an expense standpoint, but either way, your tenants are paying it, and they can only pay so much rent. It's base rent plus CAM. So if your CAM is another dollar higher, then your base rent is going to have to suffer.
That's a good lesson. And the last question I have for you is, where can our audience learn more about your company and connect with you?
We recently just revamped our website. It should be launching in around 3 weeks. We still have one, but it's just, quite frankly, not where it should be, the one that's currently online. But you can find us at Sun, that's S-U-N, Cap, C-A-P, Fund, F-U-N-D.com. And you can find all the information about us there, as well as my LinkedIn page. And that'll be Michael Reed 41, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-R-E-I-D 41. You can find information about me there. As well as feel free to reach out to me via email. Happy to connect with any and all of you at michael.parrott@suncapfund.com. And I'll be happy to provide that to you and put it in the podcast information.
Yeah, we'll be sure to link to all of those. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today and giving your background and your experiences with your fund and FlexSpace and commercial retail. I've learned a lot. Hope our audience enjoyed it as much as I did. So thank you.
Absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on and hope to do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Best ever listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a 5-star review. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss anything. And I hope you all have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access and you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.